Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true? They don't think Christianity's true. They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
What is the most important thinking skill you need to have to defend the truth? The most important thinking skill. We haven't talked about this on this program in a while. We're going to talk about it today. And in fact, last week we had a program where we basically talked about the top questions to ask unbelievers or non-Christians. We're going to continue that today because we only got through about half of the ones that I had written down. And we'll get to your phone calls as well because we had some great input last week from you. And so we're going to go a little bit further. But we're going to talk a lot today about the most important thinking skill you need to have. The most important conversational tactic in defending the truth of Christianity. And actually, not just Christianity, but the truth in general. And before I get to it, let me just review briefly what we did last week. Last week, we started to give some questions that you ought to ask unbelievers. And I think that one of the most important questions that you need to ask unbelievers, especially if you're in a conversation with somebody and you can sense that maybe the other person isn't quite open to Christianity because they keep coming up with objections and they don't even acknowledge a good point maybe that you've made in support of Christianity. They just go on to the next objection. When I have people like that, I ask them, hey, if I ask you an important question, will you give me a brutally honest answer? Just about everybody says yes. Then you ask them the question. And the question is, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? That's where we started last week. If Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? What does that question do? It clears the decks. It blows away all the smoke. It gets right to the heart of the matter because quite frequently, people who are not Christians because they don't want to be Christians. They don't want to give up something that they think Christianity will cause them to give up or will require them to give up. They want to do their own thing. They don't want to bow their knee to a creator. They want to have accountability to no one but themselves, which is why Pascal said people almost invariably arrive at their beliefs, not on the basis of proof, but on the basis of what they find attractive. They find something that's attractive and they want to believe it. And anything that might cause them to have to give up that thing, whatever it is, they will resist. Because we're not just intellectual beings. We're also emotional and volitional beings. It's not that if you just give somebody the truth, like some process of chemistry, they're going to assent to the truth. You can prove something to someone, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be persuaded by it. They might not want to be persuaded by it. There's a difference between proof and persuasion. You can prove something logically. You can have very good evidence for your position. However you define proof, say beyond a reasonable doubt. But somebody might not be persuaded by it for a number of reasons. Intellectually, they might not see it, but quite frequently, it's not just that they don't see it. Maybe they do see it. They just don't want to assent to it. So you have to ask the question, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? That's one of the key questions. But I want to talk about something, as I mentioned at the top of the program here, that I think is the most important thinking skill you need to have. And if you understand this particular tactic we're going to talk about, I think about half of your work is done in defending the truth of Christianity against false claims. Half of your work is done. Just learning this one tactic. You actually already know it. You just might not know you know it. And this tactic, defending the truth, is just applying the law of non-contradiction. What is the law of non-contradiction? The law of non-contradiction says opposite ideas cannot be both true at the same time and in the same sense. For example, the earth can't be both round and not round at the same time in the same sense. It's either round or it's not round, but it's not both, right? It's one or the other. Same thing is true of the existence of God. Either God exists or he doesn't exist. There's no middle alternative there. Either he does or he doesn't. He can't exist and not exist at the same time and in the same sense. You can't be pregnant and not pregnant at the same time and in the same sense, right? You can't be alive and not alive at the same time and in the same sense. It's the law of non-contradiction. If you say you are alive but you're not alive, you're contradicting yourself. What are some examples of self-defeating statements? These are statements that somehow run afoul of the law of non-contradiction. Like if I were to say, I can't speak a word in English, you'd go, hey, wait, didn't you just say that in English? You see, the statement doesn't meet its own standard. I can't speak a word in English is a statement in English, so it defeats itself. Or another statement that's self-defeating would be to say, there are no sentences in the English language longer than 3 words. Well, that's quite obviously a statement that's longer than 3 words, or a sentence that's longer than 3 words. So that statement defeats itself. Oh, there's some more fun self-defeating statements. At least they're practically self-defeating, like my brother is an only child, or my parents had no kids that lived. Okay. These are self-defeating statements. Now, the interesting aspect of this is that so much of what you hear about in our culture today, particularly claims that are against the Christian faith, are logically self-defeating. They defeat themselves because they don't meet their own standards. They violate the law of non-contradiction. And what you need to do in order to get good at this is you simply need to analyze statements to see if they meet their own standards. You got to take a statement that somebody says and see if it meets its own standard. These statements are all over our culture today. And once you get good at identifying them and simply asking a question in response, you're going to get very good at refuting false claims. And by the way, if you're trying to get somebody to believe Christianity or to adopt your worldview, quite frequently, you need to get them to doubt their own worldview first. They're not just going to accept your worldview without doubting their own. And one of the ways you can get them to doubt their own worldview is to point out that their own worldview is logically inconsistent. Logically inconsistent. So turn a claim on itself to see if it meets its own standard. For those of you who are familiar with the book I wrote with Dr. Norman Geiser called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, we call this tactic of turning a claim on itself, we call it in the book, the Roadrunner tactic. Why? Because it reminds us of Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner. What's Wile E. Coyote's only mission in life? To catch the Roadrunner and eat him. I don't know why Roadrunner does not look like a very tasty meal, but in any event, he's trying to catch the Roadrunner, and just as it looks like he's about to catch him, Roadrunner stops short of the cliff, and Coyote goes blowing by him, and then he's hanging in midair until he realizes he's got no ground to stand on, and then he plummets to the valley floor in a heap. That's exactly what you can do to people who utter self-defeating statements. You can show them that they have no ground to stand on, that their statement is foundationless, so it can't be true. What are some examples of self-defeating statements we hear in our culture every day? Well, the postmodern or relativistic view says there is no truth. Now, in order to refute this claim, you simply need to apply the claim to itself. If somebody says there is no truth, you need to ask a question. What's the question? When they say there is no truth, simply ask them, is that true? Is it true that there is no truth? Because if it's true that there is no truth, then the claim there is no truth can't be true, but it claims to be true. In fact, that's how our program starts, that little intro to the program. When people say there is no truth, simply ask them, is that true? Or if people say all truth is relative, what question should you ask them? Apply the claim to itself. Is that a relative truth? No, quite obviously, it's an absolute truth. Because you're saying it's absolutely true that all truth is relative. That is an absolute truth claim, so it defeats itself. It's like saying I can't speak a word in English. It's like saying my brother is an only child. It's like saying everything I say is a lie. Well, that's a self-defeating statement. Now we're going to get into more of these after the break and get to your phone calls a little bit later. 888-589-8840. 888-589-8840. Hey, how do you deal with it's true for you but not for me? We're going to do it right after the break and also deal with the question, how do you deal with somebody who says there are no absolutes? Back in two.
Hello, everyone. We have some spaces available for our trip to Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. Just a few seats left, and we'd like for you to go with us. I'm Tim Wildman. Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown, September 15th through the 18th. For more information on this very special trip, go to spiritualheritagetours.com, spiritualheritagetours.com, and click on Williamsburg. It's a great place to visit. The folks there walking the streets dress up as if they're living in the 18th century, and they tell the story of Williamsburg and Jamestown and Yorktown, and you'll never forget it, and you will greatly appreciate American history and the Christian influence after visiting with us. So, for more information, again, go to spiritualheritagetours.com, spiritualheritagetours.com, or you can call us for a brochure at 800-FAMILIES, option 5.
G'day guys, I'm Luke.
And I'm Joel, and we're with For King and Country.
We wanted to tell you that there is a way out of drug addiction, no matter how hopeless things might seem.
My addiction was about 12 years of doing absolutely anything it took for me to get drugs. Before I came to Teen Challenge, I was in jail. I got down on my knees for the first time in my life, and I said, God, if you give me a chance to change my life, I will. I went into the courtroom, and the judge looked at me and said, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I'm going to let you go to Teen Challenge. One of the first scriptures you learn here is that nothing's impossible for God. Through this last year of my life, God's done the impossible, and God's fixed those things in my life.
For more than 50 years, Teen Challenge has been helping both teens and adults find a life of freedom. With hundreds of locations across America, they can help you or your loved one too. You can find the location nearest you at 417-581-2181 or online at teenchallengeusa.com.
You're listening to American Family Radio.
What are the best questions to ask unbelievers? If you're low on the FM dial looking for NPR, go no further. We're hopefully going to tell you the truth here. That's our intent anyway. And if you don't think we are, you can call us at 888-589-8840. 888-589-8840. We began talking today about the law of non-contradiction and applying the law of non-contradiction to statements we hear in our culture today. All through our culture, we hear these statements. People say there is no truth. You should ask them, is that true? People say all truth is relative. You should ask them, is that a relative truth? What if they say there are no absolutes? Apply the claim to itself. Simply ask, is that an absolute? Or you might say, are you absolutely sure? I know you're using the word absolute in a different sense there, but you get the idea. They are claiming that there are no absolutes, yet the statement, there are no absolutes, is an absolute itself. Now, let me draw a point of clarification here. It is not self-defeating to say there are no moral absolutes. Why? Because that itself is not a moral absolute. It is self-defeating to say there are no absolutes, as in saying there are no truths that are absolute, because that is a truth that is absolute or claims to be absolute. But to say there are no moral absolutes is not logically self-defeating. It's practically self-defeating. Why? Because as soon as somebody says that, there are no moral absolutes, if you were to say, oh, sit down and shut up, you don't have a right to your opinion, they'd say, well, I certainly do. In other words, when you start treating people immorally, then they suddenly realize that their rights are being violated. And if there are no moral absolutes, there are no rights, no absolute rights, yet they act as if there are. So on a practical level, while people may claim there are no moral absolutes, as soon as you treat them immorally, they are going to react as if you've done something absolutely wrong. In fact, it's much easier to understand morality, not by our actions, but by our reactions. For example, if I steal from you, I may be able to rationalize that away and say, well, it's not really wrong. But what do I say the second you steal from me? Hey, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. In other words, we know moral absolutes or moral or objective moral values more by our reactions than our actions. We do all sorts of immoral things to people every day, and we rationalize that away. But when somebody treats us immorally, then bang, we understand it quite clearly that that was absolutely wrong. And by the way, there is a difference between, and I'm digressing a little bit here, but this is an important distinction. When we say that there are no there are moral absolutes, that there are objective moral values, we are not just saying that we know those objective moral values. Of course, we have to know them. But when we make that claim that objective moral values show that there is a God out there, we are not just saying we just know these values. We are saying that the only way to ground those values is if God exists. Because, you know, atheists come up with all sorts of different ways to know right from wrong. Evolution, society, parents, whoever. Yeah, okay, fine. Even if all those things were true, that would not tell us why there are certain things that are right and wrong. On atheism, there's no way to justify rightness or wrongness because there's no such thing as rightness out there, not an objective way. If we're just molecules in motion, then there is no such thing as a true rightness and therefore something as a true objective wrongness. It's just a matter of opinion. So we're not talking about how we know morality. We're talking about that there is a morality out there, and that requires an unchanging, objective, authoritative standard that is God's nature. If God doesn't exist, it's all reduced to human opinion. Whose opinion? Well, it's just all subjective opinions. It's all in the minds of the subject, us. Whose opinion? Mother Teresa's or Hitler's? But I digress. Let me go back to this issue of truth now. How about if somebody says to you, it's true for you, but not for me? How is that self-defeating? Well, it is self-defeating. It's just a little bit more subtle. This violates the law of non-contradiction. How so? Well, the way to point out to somebody, it's true for you, but not for me, the way to point out that that is logically self-defeating is this. If they say to you, it's true for you, but not for me, simply ask them, hey, is that true for everybody? Is true for you, but not for me, true for everybody? Because if true for you, but not for me, is true for everybody, then true for you, but not for me, can't be true because it's true for everybody. Did you follow that? Yeah, I know that can give you intellectual constipation if you think about it long enough, but that's because it violates the law of non-contradiction. It's just against reality. It violates the law of non-contradiction. It can't be true. Actually, there's a more fun way of dealing with this. If somebody says it's true for you but not for me, say, sure, go try that with your bank teller. Go to your bank teller one day and say, look, I'd like $100,000 out of my account. The bank teller looks up your account and says, I'm sorry, you only have $14.12 in your account. That's easy to get the money. You simply say, ha, that's true for you but not for me. Give me the 100 grand. Are you going to get the money? No. If it's true, there's only $14.12 in your account. That's true for all people at all times in all places when referring to your account at that time. It's not just true for you. It's true for everybody because that's just the state of affairs. Now, I go to a lot of churches and college campuses, and usually when I go to a church, I'll hold up the Bible and I'll say, do you believe this book is true? And most people will say, well, yes. And then I'll ask them, why? You know what answer I get more than any other? Because I have faith. Is that a good answer? Because I have faith? Does your faith change whether or not the Bible is true? Does your faith change whether or not God exists or Jesus rose from the dead? No, your faith doesn't change a thing about those things. I mean, does God pop into existence because you believe in him? And does he go out of existence if you don't believe in him? I mean, do you have to believe something to make it true? Do you have to believe in gravity to stay on the ground? Do people who don't believe in gravity float away? No. Truth is independent of what you think about it. And so your faith doesn't change a thing about whether or not Christianity is true. You say, why is the Bible always talking about faith then? Because there's two kinds of faith. There's belief that and belief in. What's belief that? Belief that is getting evidence that God exists, that Jesus rose from the dead, that the Bible is true. That's what apologetics does. Apologetics means giving evidence for what you believe. Now, you're not apologizing. You're not saying you're sorry. You're giving evidence. You're defending your position. But all the belief that in the world won't get you saved according to Christianity. In fact, James, the half-brother of Jesus who wrote that little book called James, says, even the demons believe that God exists, but they tremble. They know intellectually God exists, but they don't trust in God, in Christ. And that's the difference between belief that and belief in. Belief that is just intellectual. You can intellectually know it, but not trust in it. fact, when I first met my wife about 28 years ago, I got evidence that she would be a good wife. But all the evidence in the world didn't make her my wife. I had to take a step of trust in her to ask her to be my wife. And in a momentary lapse of judgment, she said yes. See, there's a difference between belief that, which is just intellectual, and belief in, which is not only intellectual, but also volitional. In other words, it's part of your will. And that's going back to the top of the program. There's a lot of people that intellectually know that God exists and that Christianity is true, but they don't trust in Christ. Why? Because they don't want to. They want to do other things. And God's getting in the way. How about for people who say you can't know truth? What would you say to somebody who says that? Once again, apply the claim to itself. Then how do you know that's true? Or you can't know the real world, as Immanuel Kant said. You can't know the real world. Why can't you know the real world? Because there's a real world out there. But when the phenomena from the real world gets to your mind categorizes it in such a way that you can't know the real world in itself. You can only know what your mind does to the phenomena from the real world. Yeah, leave it to a philosopher to come up with this. There's one problem with that. It violates the law of non-contradiction. Why? Because if Kant says you can't know the real world, I would ask him, then how can you know that about the real world? Why can Kant know about the real world, but we can't? See, it violates the law of non-contradiction. This way, you've got to get good at identifying self-defeating statements. Just simply apply the claim to itself. How about somebody says all truth depends on your perspective? What should you ask them? Well, does that truth depend on your perspective? You see, they're claiming an objective perspective in order to say that. And this is the problem with relativism. The problem with relativism is it exempts, or relativists exempt themselves from their own rules. Everything else is relative except my position. Everything depends on your perspective, but my perspective is objective. All truth depends on your interpretation, but not mine, you see? When they say all truth depends on your interpretation, you ought to ask them, is that your interpretation, see? I have an objective perspective, the rest of you don't. That's what the relativist is saying. Or if they say you should doubt everything, what should you ask them? Well, should I doubt that? You see, why are skeptics skeptical of everything but skepticism? Why? Why? Now, by the way, everybody has doubts. Look, I have doubts. I wrote a book called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, but I still have doubts. But most of the time when I consider my doubts, I realize that my doubts are not intellectual. They're emotional. What do I mean by that? Well, I wake up one morning and think, well, I don't even know if there's a God. Other days, I'm all fired up, you know. Why is that? Well, the facts haven't changed. I've changed. The facts are good. I look at the facts for Christianity and go, hey, these are quite good. Beyond a reasonable doubt, it's true. But some days I'm having a good day, everything's fine. Other days I'm having a bad day, everything's not so fine. What's changed? The fact? No, facts haven't changed. I've changed. Emotions come and go. Feelings come and go. And oh, by the way, let me digress again. This is why you can't base a marriage on feelings. Because feelings come and go. You can't base relationships on feelings. Feelings come and go. Only facts stay the same. And when you vow to somebody that you are going to love them, which, by the way, isn't a feeling either, till the day you die, then that's what you do. That's a vow. You can't vow that you're going to feel the same way for the next 50 years. You couldn't do that if you wanted to. And it'd be highly undesirable if you, even if you could. Who could bear what the C.S. Lewis says in his book, Mere Christianity? Who could bear with that feeling of excitement that you have when you first meet somebody who you're romantically attracted to? Who could bear to live with that for even 5 years? Your heart beating like a hummingbird all the time. You'd be dead after 5 years. Couldn't be able to do anything else but think about the other person. Be a disaster. So don't base relationships on feelings. Base them on facts. So when someone says you should doubt everything, ask them, should I doubt that? You see, you ought to start doubting your doubts, because if you start doubting your doubts, then you're back to knowing something for sure. Now, there's many more of these we're going to do after the break, and we're going to get to your phone calls after the break. If you've got questions that you think you ought to ask unbelievers, then you want to give us a call at 888-589-8840. 888-589-8840. What about the objection, don't impose your morals on me, or you ought not judge? We're going to get to that after the break, because those are self-defeating as well. and join us. 888-589-8840. I'm Frank Turek, back in just 2 minutes. Don't go away.
This is Buddy Smith, Executive Vice President of American Family Association. With all that's happening today, it may seem that conservatism in America is dead. Well, let me assure you, conservatism is alive and well, but the battle is intense. To help equip cultural soldiers every year in October, AFA Action is a sponsor of the Values Voters Summit. This year, the summit will feature many of the voices you hear on our family of stations, including AFR talk show hosts Tony Perkins, Alex McFarlane, and Sandy Rios, commentator Todd Starnes, and from our new Urban Family Talk Network, Star Parker. They'll join folks like Governor Rick Perry, Gary Bauer, Joel Rosenberg, Senator Ted Cruz, Governor Mike Huckabee, Dean McStaver, Senator Rand Paul, and many, many more. To learn more and to register, visit valuesvotersummit.org.
The Pocket Testament League presents Pocket Power. Read, carry, and share the gospel every day. If you've ever failed to share your faith because you just didn't know what words to use, then carry the word with you.
My family and I have the privilege to lead a homeless ministry. We hand out clothing at 4 different shelters and give out the Gospels of John. They're perfect because of their size.
Hello, this is Mike Brickley, president of the Pocket Testament League. Reading the Bible every day is so easy when you always have it with you. You won't even need a backpack. You can carry one right in your pocket. What are you waiting for?
I give the Gospels out to people at grocery stores, in restaurants, when shopping. I hand them to people that have time to read. I pray before I give them out, and I ask God to send the Holy Spirit to convict their hearts.
What are you waiting for? Read, carry, and share the gospel every day. For more information, call 1-800-636-8785 or visit pocketpower.org. That's pocketpower.org.
Triple 888-589-8840. 888-589-8840. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. We're talking about questions you ought to ask unbelievers. We spent most of the program today talking about what I call the roadrunner tactic, that's applying the law of non-contradiction to people who say self-defeating statements. Like when they say there is no truth, you want to ask them, is that true? When they say that all truth is relative, is that a relative truth? When they say there are no absolutes, you might want to say, are you absolutely sure? When they say it's true for you but not for me, you want to say, is that true for everybody? When they say you can't know truth, you want to ask them, then how do you know that? When they say all truth depends on your perspective, you ought to ask them, does that truth depend on your perspective, etc.? We're going to get to a couple others, like don't impose your morals on me and you ought not judge, but people have been waiting on the phone lines for a while, so let's get to your phone calls first. Again, 888-589-8840. Let's start with John in the great state of Florida. John, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead, sir.
Hi, Frank.
How you doing?
Glory, honor, and peace.
You too, sir.
You was talking about Jesus allowing all this to happen to us, and the reason why Jesus is allowing it, because we have turned away from him.
Well, that's certainly true. I think if you look at the news headlines today, you can see our country has turned far away from Jesus. And you know who's to blame for that? It's us, the church, because the church hasn't been the church in this country for the past 100 years. It's become a separatist kind of group that decides it's not going to get involved in anything other than missionary work, which, by the way, I'm all for missionary work. Don't get me wrong. But we've bifurcated life into two segments. We've bifurcated life into a sacred side of life and a secular side of life. And we've bought into this idea that the Christian should even have a secular side of life. No, everything we do is for the glory of God. And we need to be involved in all levels of reality, all levels of life. That includes politics. That includes medicine. That includes education. That includes a business. That includes any and all areas of life and vocations of life. Christians ought to be Christians wherever they are. We haven't done that, John. That's why our country's going godless. We take the godly people out of society, they go godless.
Thanks for your show. I love it. And it might have deep philosophical ramifications if we listen to it.
Yes, sir, it does. Thanks so much for the call, John. Let me move on to Lauren in South Carolina. Lauren, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm enjoying the program so much. I have something I've thought about, and I kind of want to write a book about it or something, but I'd like to hear your feedback on it. When you look at the issue of conscience, mm-hmm. I think that's something that a lot of Americans don't understand, and that's why it's hard for them to grasp the idea of having tolerance but also morality. And I was wondering, when you're talking to someone who doesn't believe in Christianity, and you say there are rights and wrongs, there are moral absolutes, but at the same time you can say there are issues of conscience, so some things may be right for me but not right for you, how can you explain that to somebody while at the same time holding to the idea of moral absolutes, that there are issues of particular freedoms or conscience?
That's an excellent question, Lauren. And, you know, the Apostle Paul deals with that very, very well, as you know, in Romans chapter 14, where he basically says that you ought not major in the minors, that what might be a problem in your conscience is not a problem for me, and vice versa. So we ought not impose our ideas on disputable matters on one another, where I might think, and he uses drinking wine as one of the examples. I might think that drinking wine is a problem. You might think it's not. I ought not put my prohibition on you, and vice versa. So there are disputable areas of conscience, but you see, that particular moral command or moral precept by Paul is itself a moral absolute. What's the moral absolute? Don't impose your view on disputable matters on others. Now, we all know there are disputable matters, and we all know that there are matters that are not disputable, like you ought not murder people, that you ought not torture babies for fun. But even if there are disputable matters, and we might even argue over what are disputable matters, areas that have or that we might dispute does not mean there aren't areas that are not disputable, like the examples I just mentioned. Torturing babies for fun is wrong, no matter who says it's not wrong. We all know it is, because it's grounded in the very nature of God that we ought not torture people or murder people, particularly torturing babies for fun. So while there may be ambiguity in some moral absolutes or in some moral areas, there's not moral ambiguity in others. I don't know if that helps your question or not. You still there, Lauren?
Explain that. Yeah, are you there?
I'm here. Go ahead.
Oh, I was talking to someone. I was trying to kind of explain this about an area, and this person wasn't a Christian, and I realized, gosh, I sound like I'm advocating relativism to her. And I was, you know, if I say that to someone, and then they come back and say, I could imagine her saying, well, then I guess it really does just depend on my truth and your truth. And then they might say, but which truths are absolute and which truths aren't? And then I guess that's where you get back to God's word, right? I mean, how do you philosophically address that without contradicting, you know, falling into the law of non-contradiction?
Well, you first of all, you don't need the Bible to know basic right and wrong. If you did, then God was unjust for punishing the entire generation of Noah, because they didn't have a Bible, right? Paul says in Romans chapter 2 that we have the law written on our hearts. Of course, our country was founded on this same kind of idea, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So we know basic right and wrong because God has written it on our hearts. It flows from His nature. So you don't need the Bible to know right from wrong. It gives you more detail, quite obviously. It may be clear on other issues that conscience can't tell you directly, but on the big issues of right and wrong, you don't need to know the Bible. Now, you're not being a relativist when you have to see the situation in order to discover what moral absolute to follow. That's not relativism. Right. The situation will give you data that will help you discover what the right thing to do is. And even if you can't figure out what the right thing to do is, that doesn't mean there isn't a right thing to do in that situation, or there isn't a right thing to do in another situation. A relativist would say that the situation helps you determine right from wrong based on whatever you feel like doing. That's relativism. That's not moral absolutism or moral objectivism. So there's a difference. A situation is always going to tell you, or let me put it another way. You need some context to try and discover what the right thing to do is. But the context itself just provides the circumstances. It isn't in you that you're not deciding. You're trying to discover based on the context. In relativism, you're deciding what to do, not discovering what to do. Does that help?
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you so much.
By the way, Lauren, are you driving in South Carolina? Where are you?
I am. I confess I'm driving. I'm talking on the phone.
No, that's okay. Fine. I do that all the time. And in our state, you can do that. I'm just curious to know what station you're listening to.
Let me turn on my radio again. I think it is 90.5 FM, and I'm near Dillon, South Carolina, near Fairmont, I guess. I'm headed towards North Carolina.
All right. Well, we live in North Carolina, so welcome to North Carolina when you get here, and thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I appreciate it. 888-589-8840. Let me move on to Richard, who is in New York. Richard, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead, sir.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go.
I wanted to point out that most of the questions that you asked were defensive questions. They're responses to arguments, but there are a number of good questions that you could ask the non-believers that are offensive. For example, I might ask, could the cause of all nature, space, and time be natural, spatial, and temporal? I was wondering what you thought of that and if you had any other positive or offensive questions.
Yeah, actually, and I know what you mean by offensive. You don't mean as in off-putting or insulting. You mean...
No.
Although, being from New York and me being from New Jersey, we do that all the time, don't we, Richard?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I understand what you mean by that. Yeah, no, there are plenty of good questions like that because when we're using the Roadrunner tactic, they are defensive. In other words, they're trying – well, they're offensive in a certain sense that you're asking a question to show that what the other person believes is false. But, yeah, there are questions that are more positive in nature, the one you just mentioned, that if space, time, and matter had a beginning, how can the cause be made of space, time, and matter? It can't. Leibniz put the question this way: if there is no God, why is there something rather than nothing at all, right? Why does anything exist if God doesn't exist? So that's a good offensive question. A caller last week, Doug from Minnesota, had a great question that he uses when he goes to a festival or a carnival of some kind, and he's just walking around and he says, "Hey, do you have time for a one question survey?" People always go, "Sure." And they'll ask, from 0 to 100%, how sure are you that you're going to heaven? Right? That's a good question. It gets right to the point. Of course, if they believe in the authority of the Bible at all, he just turns to Romans chapter 10 and points out the verse that says you can know you have salvation. What other questions that are good to ask? J. Warner Wallace, who coming to our Cross-Examine Instructor Academy. He's the guy that wrote Cold Case Christianity. He has a good question that he thinks works pretty well. And the question is, what do you think happens when you die? And that's kind of an unoffensive question. And what I mean by that, it's not insulting and it doesn't sound too churchy, but it gets people talking. So then you can try and figure out where the person is. So there are several other questions you can ask. You can ask what a good question that I ask on college campuses a lot, Richard, which may seem strange that I would ask this question, particularly of atheists, but I do because usually they're coming to the seminar that I do called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And I'll ask, have you ever read the Gospels or have you ever read the Bible or just the Gospels? Do you know, a lot of times they stumble over themselves because they really haven't. Yet here they are making these pronunciations on Jesus that he never existed or that, you know, he wasn't who you Christians say he was when they haven't really even investigated Jesus for themselves. So I think it's quite telling that people who claim that they're atheists or non-believers don't really investigate it. They don't want to believe it. And so they decide that they're not going to believe it, and they're not even going to investigate it. And you can expose that by simply asking them the question. Hey, thanks for the call, Richard. 888-589-8840, 888-589-8840, if you'd like to be on the program. We're talking about what questions to ask unbelievers. And we'll get to many more right after the break. And in fact, we'll get to that you ought not judge thing and don't impose your morals on me here in just a minute. So give us a call. Back in 2 minutes. I'm Frank Turek. Hi, this is Frank Turek, co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Do you have evidence that Christianity is true? Can you answer the atheists, the skeptics, the agnostics, the people in your community who say Christianity's false and that the Bible's full of myths? Well, join me every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central for Cross-Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. It also airs Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m. Central. I hope to see you there.
Feel like we're being ignored?
Sir, you're my congressman. Why are you ignoring me?
You're not going to tell me how to run my congressional office.
Focal Point wants you to know that your voice is valued.
Thank you for taking my call today, Mr. Fisher.
You bet. Jimmy, you're on Focal Point with Brian Fisher. What's on your mind today?
Weigh in with Brian Fisher, Monday through Friday from 1 till 3 p.m. Central on AFR Talk.
There's somebody that I have to put on my list to say I want to call to be on my side. It's going to be Brian Fisher.
My name's Garrett, and a few years ago, I went through one of those life-shattering events as I watched my marriage crumble and I became a statistic of divorce. Now, there were some pretty dark days. How could a Christian guy get divorced? I mean, I was the guy who told others how faithful God was, and then all of a sudden, my shortcomings were made public, and there I was, a statistic. Then a couple of great guys reminded me of what God's Word says about a bunch of men and women who goofed up, messed up, and even went through rough stuff like divorce. Isn't that just like God to say, hey, I love you anyway, even if you are divorced? Well, today I still don't have it all together, but I do know that Jesus has changed me, restored me, and I'm becoming the dad and the new husband that He wants me to be. If you're there today and you don't think there's any hope, think again. Jesus is ready to spend some time with you on the road to restoration. You can meet Him right now. Just call 888-NEED-HIM or chat with us live at needhim.org.
Hey, you know what? You ought not impose your morals on me. You hear that all the time, don't you? You know what you ought to ask Him? Is that your moral view? Then why are you imposing it on me? How can you say you ought not impose ought nots when you're imposing that ought not on me? And by the way, when people say you ought not impose your morals on me, you can also answer this way. Hey, these aren't my morals. I didn't make them up. I didn't make up the fact that murder is wrong, that abortion is murder. I didn't make up the fact that men were made for women and women were made for men. I didn't make up the fact that rape is wrong and theft is wrong. These aren't my morals. I didn't make them up. These are just the self-evident morals that we all understand to be true because they come from the Creator. These are self-evident. You can suppress them. You can deny them. You can go your own way because God gives you free will. But don't tell me that I'm imposing my morality because it's not my morality. I'm not God. I didn't make it up. I'm just saying, let's just recognize it. And you're trying to impose your morality on me. And by the way, newsflash, you always hear you can't legislate morality. Newsflash, all laws legislate morality. The only question is whose morality? Everybody's trying to impose a morality. Let me go back to Lauren's call a few minutes ago from South Carolina. Another thing you can say to people who say, well, you know, whose standard should we go by? Look, it's either going to be a human standard or a divine standard. There's no other option. It's either human or it's not. Right? If it's human standard, then who says? Mother Teresa or Hitler? If it's divine standard, somebody with authority, somebody who doesn't change, somebody who is the ground of morality, then that's objective. Anything else is subjective. A human standard is subjective. It's a changeable human opinion. Which human? Mother Teresa or Hitler? You might ask someone, is this just your preference? Is it just based on your own desires? Or are you saying there's an unchangeable standard outside of yourself that's authoritative from which you get this moral claim? You see, a divine standard is subjective. It's unchangeable. It's divine authority. So by what standard do you judge that my position is wrong and your position is right? And this is big in political debates, right? We have a right to choose. Who said? We have a right to same-sex marriage. Who said? We have a right to health care. Who said? We have a right to welfare. Who said? We have a right to whatever. By the way, the issue of welfare, everybody believes you ought to help the poor. The question is, how do we help the poor? A lot of liberal Christians will say, well, the Bible says help the poor, so the government ought to help the poor. Well, first of all, how does the government help the poor? Is it to give them handouts, or is it to encourage the private sector to do so, particularly churches, faith-based organizations? What works best? Creating opportunities so people can get themselves out of poverty, or government handouts, which create dependency? And when they say, by the way, the Bible says you ought to help the poor, that's true. But is that a command for government directly? The Bible also says you ought to preach the gospel. So that should the government be preaching the gospel? If you want to say everything in the Bible the government ought to do, then the government ought to be preaching the gospel. Whoa, there goes your coveted separation of church and state, doesn't it? See, we got to draw the right distinctions here. All right, let me go to Don in Dallas. Don, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead, sir.
Well, thank you for your program. I've enjoyed listening to it for some time now.
Thanks, Don.
And the last couple of weeks, as you've been talking about questions to ask unbelievers, I've been thinking about some training I've received from spreadtruth.com, mm-hmm. and on the other website is viewthestory.com. They have a story approach to sharing the gospel, and it starts off with asking four questions, worldview questions. Mm-hmm. How did the world begin? What went wrong? Is there any hope? And what will the future hold?
Oh, good questions.
And then you walk them through, and then you find out their answers first. Mm-hmm. And then, well, may I share what the Bible has to say about those things? And you talk about creation, fall, and restoration, mm-hmm. with the Bible verses that go with it. So that's kind of the approach that I have found to be very helpful in conversations.
So, hey, Don, go over those questions again, just so everyone will get them. Go ahead.
Sure. Again, the website spreadtruth.com, mm-hmm. In case you don't get them all. But the questions are, I'm fumbling it about here. How did it all begin, meaning mm-hmm. the world?
Yep.
What went wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any hope? And what will the future hold?
Mm-hmm.
And the premise is to give them an idea to, for them to express what they think,
mm-hmm.
but then also for the Christian that's sharing with them to find out, okay, how can I tailor the gospel message?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because you don't want to try and give people an answer they're not looking for. And so when they say something, then you can ask them the other questions we talked about in the last show. In fact, let me just go over them very briefly. The questions are, what do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? And then have you ever considered? And that's where you fill in the blank with some evidence back, because you never know what kind of response you're going to get when you ask those four questions you mentioned, Don. So you have to then ask questions of them so you can clarify what they mean. Because when someone says something, it's not your job to refute what they say. It's their job to support what they say. So you're saying, ask, how did the world begin? What went wrong? Is there any hope? And what does the future hold?
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. And the website is spreadtruth.com. Thanks, Don. I got plenty of other calls. I appreciate it. That's a very good approach. So hopefully there's some folks out there that might want to take that to heart. All right, let me move on to Anita in Oregon. Anita, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead, ma'am.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
I've got a friend who's a Scientologist.
Uh-huh.
And I know there's two big areas where they're just off. they believe in reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And also that people are basically good.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, what's the best way to approach the first part of that about reincarnation?
Well, again, my question is going to be, first of all, what do you mean by reincarnation? And get them to explain it. And then how did you come to that conclusion that it's true? And then I might add, have you ever considered that with reincarnation, you have to come from a prior existence, right?
Right.
And usually you're paying for something you did in your prior existence. You're being rewarded for something that you did in your prior existence. So I might ask, in my first life, what was I paying back, or what was I being rewarded for? Also, I might ask the question, Who keeps track of all this karma? In other words, who keeps track of whether I ought to be punished in my next life or rewarded in my next life? It would seem that that would require a mind like God to know, well, Turek did bad in his previous life, so in this next life, he's going to get hammered, right? You would need a mind to do that. So basically what reincarnation folks are doing is they're borrowing from God in order to make their worldview work. So I might ask those questions, Anita. Do those make sense?
Yeah.
Try that, because they're going to be flummoxed. Because if there is no mind out there, a divine mind, which is exactly what we mean by God, then no one could keep track of reincarnation. No one could. And it also presupposes a moral law, by the way. It presupposes that there's a standard of rightness that people ought to obey. And when they don't obey it, they get punished in the next life. When they do obey it, they get rewarded in the next life. Well, where does this moral law come from? It certainly doesn't come from an Eastern view where there's no personal God. So they're borrowing from a personal moral God in order to make their whole system work. Make sense?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Anita. That. I got to squeeze in a few more. Let me go to Pete in Indiana. Pete, we got just a minute or two. Hit it.
Okay.
Go ahead, sir.
Hello?
Yeah, Pete, you're on. Go.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to say that the people don't, that when it comes to morals, if you don't have God, you don't have morals, because everybody has a right to their own thinking. And it would be nothing but anarchy everywhere. Now you have civil authorities who impose their will, but mm-hmm. nevertheless, it's not morality. It's just what they want and what they desire.
Well, that's true in one sense. I agree with you, because they have no way to justify morality. But that doesn't mean that atheists can't be moral people. They just can't justify
morality. Oh, no, I don't mean that. I just mean that a set of moral rules. Without God, there's no one that really that you might say to be moral to or for.
Yeah, that's true. There's no justification for calling one thing right and another thing wrong. An atheist
right.
might say, well, I want to be right, or I want to behave morally to get along with other people so they don't hurt me. They might say there's a kind of reciprocity going on here. I can understand that. But there's no way to justify rightness or wrongness
in an
objective sense.
About.
Yeah, exactly. Well put, Pete. Let me get one more call in with Richard in Virginia. Richard, 1 minute. Hit it.
Thank you. With loving care, I always tell my atheist friends that there's lots of people playing the lottery now, and they're playing against hundreds of millions of 1-to-1 odds.
Uh-huh.
And if an atheist would look at Christianity in the light of a mathematical scheme, it would be 2-to-1 in our favor. If Christians are wrong, then according to the atheist philosophies, we have nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, at the same time, if Christians are correct, we have everything to gain. So I tell that lovingly to all my atheist friends.
That's true. That's kind of a modified view of Pascal's wager.
Absolutely. And God bless you guys for what you're doing.
I appreciate it, Richard. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. And friends, great calls today. Thanks for calling in. And these are good questions to ask unbelievers. I've got many others. You ought not judge. I forgot to get to that. Well, that's a judgment itself. Okay? People are judging you. Everybody makes judgments. The only question is, are your judgments true? Jesus didn't say don't judge. He said don't judge hypocritically. We all make judgments. Hey, one last thing, friends. I hardly ever talk about this. You know, this is listener-supported radio. If you like this program and want to keep it on, consider giving us a donation at crossexamined.org, crossexamined.org. You can check out our website there. We've got a lot of other resources. We have a TV program on as well. In fact, this Wednesday night, we're talking about Islam. So you may want to check that out. All the details on our website. Again, you can donate securely at crossexamined.org. We sure do appreciate it. I'm Frank Turek. Great being with you today. See you next week. God bless.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of American Family Association or American Family Radio.